Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. We do not owe that money. If they're spending money on objects or things, services, items, what have you, that are not within the Constitution, in other words, it's not delegated to them, then they can't spend the money on it. And if they are, it's fraud. It's fraudulently done. They are not our kings. The Constitution is our king. We live in a land where the law is the supreme law. It is our king. As a matter of fact, it's exactly what Adam said in framing the republican form of government, that we no longer answer to monarchs, that the law is our king and the rule of law must stand. That's why you hear that all the time, the rule of law. We can't just let people make it up as they go along, because every time they do, people die. So before I go too much further, I just needed to let you know that unfortunately, this show has been shuffled up with a couple of other shows, and so we're a little late in getting this out, but we wanted to make sure that the content that's in this, we didn't skip over anything, folks. We want to make sure that we get this content in so you get a chance to read what we're covering, because it's all about the ratification debates and the information they provided. So because we kind of lost, or I lost track of the show, it should have played like the 21st or the 22nd of May. So let's just take it from there. Anyway, this show is all about focusing on full compliance of the Constitution. That's why we're wrapping up. Yeah, I know the last episode we kind of had it out there that we were done. But actually, I found two more comments that Hamilton had two more comments that were, you know, highlighted as a part of the regular New York debates. But there was nothing we found that dealt with courts, Supreme Courts. And as a matter of fact, this topic that we're going to start off with actually deals with Supreme. The headline for it is Supreme, or the little note that I created. Oh, this one touches on Supreme, as maybe kind of a, you know, baiting people. Oh, this has something to do with the court. Because what else is supreme? So anyway, we'll be diving into that. I do not want to miss the importance of supporting and calling for you and begging, pleading. What do you need to do? I mean, I'll kiss your baby, what have you. But I gotta draw some limits. So we can negotiate stuff, but we need to get money to Gerald Wistrand, and we need your help to do that, because it's not getting cheaper. And these candidate races are critical. Having somebody that can stand behind a microphone where you may accidentally, because the news coverage may not be able to turn it off fast enough, somebody may actually say things that they don't want you to hear that you need to hear. That's how important it is. I mean, we hear everything that Trump says. And anyway, I'll stop myself there. We're not haters here. We hate everybody equally. And so that's kind of, we're equal opportunity haters, if you could say that. But anywho, we've got Sean back with us. And welcome back, Sean.
Thank you, sir. Good to be here.
So we didn't wrap up on Hamilton, per se. We got a couple more, like I said. And then I didn't want to pass completely off the New York debates. There's a couple of points that I think are worthy of being, you know, read and or diving into a little bit, because they do provide some insights on some specific topics that are, you know, that help provide details or, again, insights, so that we understand the role of the federal government as is being explained to the state of New York as well as all these other states. the powers that they have. What does that power mean? What does that line in the Constitution mean? That's what these men are doing in the ratification debates. They're literally telling you, this is what this means. Or this, you know, and, or they stipulate. They can provide stipulations that it, because of this, they'll be able to do this, this, and this. And you'll be able to expect this, this, and this. Whatever the stipulation is, those are legally binding because the contract was accepted based on how it was sold, and there was nothing nefariously done. There was no, I can't say there weren't machinations by all sorts of little evildoers, especially on the anti-federalist side. But I was shocked to find through, you know, but it took a few years, but I was shocked to find Hamilton was such a deviant. I mean, and so subversive in what he did. Anywho, because you know, I never questioned. I mean, who questioned the court that they had these powers? I mean, it didn't take me long once I actually had read and gone through the ratification debates a few times. There was no way what the court was doing was legitimate. But I never knew that there was actually legitimate language in the Federalist Papers, or I should say language in the Federalist Papers, that unconstitutionally legitimized these court overreaches or these court violations of the Constitution. It legitimized them, but not legally legitimized them. They were justified as the court said, oh, well, the Federalist Papers said we could do this because they convinced you that the Federalist Papers were the gold standard in understanding. And actually, the best way to put this, folks, when you ask what are the gold standards of the U.S. Constitution, where can we go find, you know, exactly what these clauses mean and what that document means? Oh, well, you would be shocked if somebody said, oh, well, it, you know, you'll find that all in newspaper editorials. You know, it's kind of like walking into, you know, a very serious contract that you're making with this huge multi-billion dollar contract with the government or something, and they can go, well, you know, where can we find how this was all stipulated and sold and agreed upon? Well, you'll find it in newspaper editorials. That has no legal standing. The people that are engaged, actually, there is this term. And so, Sean, have you ever heard of the term plenipotentiary?
I have run across it.
Okay. That means that this person has the legal authority to make the decisions necessary for, you know, this treaty, this contract, whatever it is, to be approved. Because treaties go through ratification processes. They go through negotiations. And the same thing with compacts and contracts. They all three fall under contract law. And so the delegates that go, they have been elected and become the plenipotentiaries of the districts that elected them. And so when you look at treaties, though, they want to make sure that the other country knows who the plenipotentiary, the official plenipotentiaries are, because there may be somebody there that's just there for administrative, secretarial, whatever. But these are the guys that we've empowered to say yes or no on our behalf, what have you. And so when you really look at this, I mean, this has been set in gold, or I should say it's been set in granite, in stone, for centuries. The authority being given, the fact that when they go through the ratification process, when people are bearing testimony, that's a legally binding testimony. But when you go and you say, oh, no, these articles that were published in these, you know, editorials that were published in the newspaper of New York, that became the full, you know, rock solid gold standard for understanding the Constitution. And folks, we had been duped. We've been duped big time because I can't believe that the legal profession even tried to, they got away with purporting that. They got away with asserting that this is our gold standard because of the names behind it. But there's no way it has any legal standing. So anyway, so Sean, we're on the 28th of Saturday, the 28th, and we're still in Alexander Hamilton's speeches. There are two comments that he makes in his 28th of, what is it, June? Yeah, June 28th speech that he makes. Now, the convention has at least another week plus. And at the very end of this, folks, I'm just going to say this now because it's in my head. At the very end of this, you'll find the Honorable Mr. Lansing. Well, what the heck's going on here? If you go to that, at the very bottom of this appendix, you'll notice that all of this text at the very bottom is highlighted. That's for a very specific purpose, because it says right here, and actually what captures it is the little paragraph underneath that, and I just want to read this little parentheses that they put underneath the Honorable Mr. Lansing. Now, Lansing was one of the guys that went to the convention with Hamilton, and I forget who the other person was. I forget. But it says right here, Mr. Hamilton here interrupted Mr. Lansing and contradicted in the most positive terms the charge of inconsistency, including in the preceding observations. This produced a warm personal altercation between those gentlemen, which engrossed the remainder of the day. In other words, they got into it, they locked horns, and it basically occupied the entire convention for the remainder of the day. So the next day, this is the entry in the next day. The personal dispute between Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Lansing was again brought forward and occupied the attention of the committee for a considerable part of the day, on the termination of which the debate upon Mr. Williams' motion was resumed and continued by Mr. Motions, Mr. Smith, Mr. Jay, Mr. Jones. And so they kind of go through this, and I think basically it was all about trying to answer something or rebuff something that Mr. Hamilton stated and so forth. But you're more than welcome to read all of this and to go, you know what, he got suspended. He got suspended, and I don't know if Livingston was the other one. Lansing and Livingston. Hamilton, Lansing, and Livingston were the three delegates. And so on Wednesday, this July 2nd, it's Mr. Livingston that comes up, and he basically, because this is where he cites Mr. Hamilton in, you know, his retort. So these guys were at odds. These three delegates, because if you really look at Lansing and Livingston, they became anti-federalists. They were not in promoting the Constitution. And going through the ratification debates, you'll realize that. Actually, the best way to determine whether you should be paying attention to the person or not is to find out how they voted ultimately at the end. Because if they voted against the Constitution, they were probably their biases were probably already there. So ultimately, you may find some anti-federalists that flip, like Samuel Adams and so forth and so on. But anyway, let me get back to what this little comment regarding Supreme that Sean is going to read for us. So go ahead, Sean. Thank you.
I have to get back to it as well, sir. I'll follow along with you.
Okay, great. That's perfect. Thank you so much.
I maintain that the word supreme imports no more than this, that the Constitution and laws made in pursuance thereof cannot be controlled or defeated by any other law. The acts of the United States, therefore, will be absolutely obligatory as to all the proper objects and powers of the general government. The states as well as individuals are bound by these laws, but the laws of Congress are restricted to a certain sphere. And when they depart from this sphere, they are no longer supreme or binding. In the same manner, the states have certain independent powers in which their laws are supreme. For example, in making and executing laws concerning the punishment of certain crimes, such as murder, theft, etc., the states cannot be controlled. With respect to certain other objects, the powers of the two governments are concurrent and yet supreme. I instanced yesterday a tax on a specific article. Both might lay the tax, both might collect it without clashing or interference. If the individual should be unable to pay both, the first seizure would hold the property. Here the laws are not in the way of each other. They are independent and supreme.
Okay, so it's really, he's talking about the supreme law of the land, not the Supreme Court. So, again, he didn't mention the court here. But interestingly enough, did you notice how he was so ambiguous as to what laws would be legitimate and what wouldn't? Because he basically said that, you know, the laws had to be within a sphere. Did you see that? But what does the Constitution say? It doesn't say a sphere. It says something very specific, that laws in pursuance to the Constitution. If you read up what the words pursuance means directly derived from. And then that's GR's interpretation, but in lieu of the powers delegated. In other words, based upon the powers, you can make these laws. That's it. And the way it was described in the ratification debates was very, very clear, where Hamilton was said, well, we just need a sphere. Well, this is where he got away with, tongue-in-cheek, saying, well, if we've got the power to, you know, take on debt, then that must mean that it implies we have the power to create a bank. They're all within the sphere, because in pursuant to, because when we went through it, I don't think we've gone through it this year, but we went through it last year. When you go through the debate on the bank, you'll actually find how both Madison and Jefferson knock it out of the park, how they talk about in pursuance to and necessary and proper. And it was very clear that Hamilton's whole foundation was based on implied powers. Period. That was it. Let's jump down to the next one. Taxation.
I shall proceed now more particularly to the proposition before the committee. This clearly admits that the unlimited power of taxation, which I have been contending for, is proper. It declares that after the states have refused to comply with the requisitions, the general government may enforce its demands. While the gentleman's proposition and principle admit this in its fullest latitude, the whole course of the states is against it. The mode they point out would involve many inconveniences against which they would wish to guard. Suppose the gentleman's scheme could be adopted. Would not all the resources of the country be equally in the power of Congress? The states can have but one opportunity of refusal. After having passed through the empty ceremony of a requisition, the general government can enforce all its demands without limitation or resistance. The states will either comply or they will not. If they comply, they are bound to collect the whole of the tax from the citizens. The people must pay it. What then will be the disadvantage of its being levied and collected by Congress in the first instance? It has been proved, as far as probabilities can go, that the federal government will, in general, take the laws of the several states as its rule and pursue those measures to which the people are most accustomed. But if the states do not comply, what is the consequence? If the power of a compulsion be a misfortune to the state, they must now suffer it without opposition or complaint. I shall show, too, that they must feel it in an aggravated degree. It may frequently happen that the states formally comply with the requisitions, the avails would not be fully realized by Congress. The states may be dilatory in the collection and payment and may form excuses for not paying the whole. There may also be partial compliances, which will subject the Union to inconveniences. Congress, therefore, in laying the tax, will calculate for these losses and inconveniences. They will make allowances for the delays and delinquencies of the states and apportion their burdens accordingly. They will be induced to demand more than their actual wants.
Okay, so in other words, we're going to have to tax you more than what the items we have to buy, because there is overhead in this process, and we have to calculate what that is. Now, in the previous, what you read, he also brought up taxation, and he basically said that the state and the federal government, the general government, can assess a tax on an item, and they can both be concurrent. But he says that, I think, did he say it was the federal government that got the grant or the power? Both might collect it without clashing or interference. If the individual should be unable to pay both, the first seizure would hold the property. In other words, whoever collected the tax first. Well, as I look at this, as we look at how excise tax is placed on liquor or excise tax is placed on gas, the retailer is the one that pays the excise tax. And so the retailer isn't paying for the whole item because the excise tax doesn't cover the cost of the whole transaction, the whole sale. So I don't know how, you know, back in those days, maybe they didn't have the ability to get down to those types of details. I just can't understand how, when they're talking about having concurrent taxes on some item, it's not saying that, you know, that whole item is ours and that we consider that as, you know, payment for a tax. No, the item itself is being taxed. So whatever the transaction is, then there is an added tax for the state and an added tax for the federal government. And this happens all the time. So I don't understand why he would even go down that path of seizure and so forth, other than the fact that maybe the taxes, and this boggles my head, because you can't come along and say, hey, we created a tax on these items. Well, I was never notified. So one of the things they have to do is, once Congress agrees on the tax, it has to get out there so that everybody knows that they have to start charging for that tax. In other words, it doesn't go into effect immediately where Congress goes out and starts collecting money on all the transactions that day. It is not reasonable for them to, you know, to be able to do that, to be able to go out, or I should say that the retailer would be able to sell that knowing that he actually having no knowledge that the tax is coming, and that when they do come along and they say, well, okay, we're taking half of what you sold that for, because that's how much tax we levied on it. You're going to have to double your sale or double the price on these items. And they've done that before where they've been very aggressive, but I've never heard of a case, have you, where they've actually gone out and, you know, without telling anybody, been able to start collecting on taxes, where the seller or whoever is having to collect the tax from the buyer to pay whomever. The whiskey tax, a good example on the whiskey tax. The whiskey tax was put upon the manufacturer. So when the manufacturer sold it, he had to pay a specific tax on that transaction. And so that tax was added. I mean, it wasn't being taken out of the cost of the item. The manufacturer had to increase his price to cover that tax. This was one of the reasons why, when they calculated everything, because the larger distilleries were able to do volume, and they were basically charging a set tax. I forget how this became the problem, but I know it was a problem because it wasn't uniform. Those who were able to produce more in a day still had to, and it, maybe they were just doing it on bulk volume or total volume for the day, that you had to pay this much. Nevertheless, the point is that Congress has the responsibility, and the state has the responsibility of communicating when a tax is being levied so that it creates a start date. I mean, I'm pretty sure in Louisiana, you know well in advance when your gas taxes are going up.
Oh, yes, sir.
It may seem...
Well, unless you're talking about... Never mind. We can go down the road.
Well, I mean, 9 times out of 10, whoever is involved in the industry and the transactions, they're always notified in advance. They're always notified. It's just like income tax doesn't go into effect until the following year, whatever the increases or decreases, because they calculate those things out. And so anyway, I don't know why Hamilton did that, other than there may have been some complications back in their days, that, you know, communications and everything else being what it is, They were just prone to having problems. So there was a seizure. I don't understand why he added that. But when we come back, what we're going to do is we're going to open up, crack open actually the New York debates and just go through a few topics in that so that we can wrap that up and then go into the Pennsylvania debates. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we want to dive into the New York debates. For the most part, the absence of Hamilton making any comments for the courts while he was writing about it in the Federalist Papers clearly means that he was deliberately trying to undermine them with the Federalist Papers. I don't see any other way you can look at it. Your comments, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, he was talking out of both sides of his mouth.
A typical lawyer, maybe?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right, and I know that there's lawyers, every time they hear that, the generalization, it just makes their blood boil. We're not all that bad. Well, if you're not that bad, I think you're an outlier today. I think you're an outlier. I can't tell you how many times I talk to people, not just lawyers. I've talked to people that have familiarized themselves so much with the law, like these patriots, that have gotten into secessions, you know, trying to sell you or convince you to give up your citizenship. These are all what we would call in the Marine Corps a sea lawyer. They're not a lawyer, but they've learned enough to try to convince you. And some of these guys have gotten really good and very well educated. They could be a lawyer. The way they talk, they could actually, you know, fool you. Yeah, that's a lawyer. But the point is that they're doing this for a purpose. And Shakespeare, you know, kill all the lawyers. Even in the Bible, Christ pointed out, well, you're a lawyer. So let's dive into the debates. This is the New York ratification debate. Since we just covered Hamilton, there's no point in coming back to this. So let's kind of put a stake in this today, if we can get through this. But Mr. Smith, who actually happens to be a pretty strong Federalist, actually starts, you know, talking about apportionment and representation. And actually, I shouldn't say he was a Federalist. He actually may be an anti-Federalist, because at this point in New York, I didn't really differentiate between these. But let's go ahead and look at what he was talking about regarding apportionment and representation. Oh, by the way, this is at the very beginning of the debate. I believe, I don't see a day on here. So it had to have been probably June 20th when they kicked it off, because the day after this, or almost after this, is June 21st. So this is at the very beginning of the debate. So let's go ahead and see what he has to say and or propose regarding apportionment and representation and his problem with it. Go ahead.
He had one more observation to make to show that the representation was insufficient. Government, he said, must rest for its execution on the good opinion of the people. For if it was made heaven and not had not the confidence of the people, it could not be executed. That this was proved by the example given by the gentlemen of the Jewish theocracy. It must have a good setting out, or the instant it takes place, there is an end of liberty. He believed that the inefficacy of the old confederation had arisen from that want of confidence, and this caused, in a great degree, by the continual declamation of gentlemen of importance against it from one end of the continent to the other, who had frequently compared it to a rope of sand. It had pervaded every class of citizens and their misfortunes. The consequences of idleness and extravagance were attributed to the defects of that system. At the close of the war, our country had been left in distress, and it was impossible that any government on earth could immediately retrieve it. It must be time and industry alone that could effect it. He said he would pursue these observations no further at present, and concluded with making the following motion. Quote, resolved that it is proper that the number of representatives be fixed at the rate of one for every 20,000 inhabitants, to be ascertained on the principles mentioned in the second section of the first article of the Constitution, until they amount to 300, after which they shall be apportioned among the states in proportion to the number of inhabitants of the states respectively, and that before the first enumeration shall be made, the several states shall be entitled to choose double the number of representatives for that purpose mentioned in the Constitution.
Okay, so as you look at this, what he's doing is he's actually, and I guess New York, when they went into this, they kind of agreed to, if they felt so moved, to create a resolution, because they were going to go through this line by line. This is a big document. And so they would gather these resolutions as they went, because they may forget something. You know, maybe old men, and back in those days, they were equally forgetful, even though, you know, they don't have heavy metal and plastics in their head and those all these things that cause dementia and Alzheimer's. But nevertheless, they had this orderly fashion of trying to create amendments that, you know, if you wanted to make an observation or what have you, you could submit a resolution so that at the end, the entire congregation or the entire delegation would go through these resolutions recommending these amendments, and they would fine-tune them at the very end. Now, we can go through all the amendments of all of these, but ultimately what happens, and what I'll do is I'll try to be attuned to, you know, what states were asking for some very specific types of amendments. Apportionment, though, here is very specific and very important, because this right here, does this jog your head or mind any regarding amendments at all?
Not really.
This right here was either the footstool or at least a prompting for the very first amendment out of the 12 amendments in the Bill of Rights, the Apportionment Amendment, where Madison basically said after 100 representatives are accumulated to representing the states, it would then be changed to 40 persons per representative. And then when it gets to 200 representatives in Congress, the apportionment would grow to 50,000. This guy wants to start it off at 20,000. He wants to go down to 10,000 and then start growing it that way. But bottom line, you can't just change that number. It had to be an amendment for that number to be changed. If it's stated in that part of the Constitution that Congress will have the power to regulate, to, you know, modify and change that number of representation, if you go to the Constitutional Convention, that is exactly what the language was. And had that language persisted as the final product, then I'm confident that the style committee would have grabbed that and said, this is something Congress has the power to control, power to regulate, power to change or make law regarding. There you go. But they didn't. They took that away from Congress. Therefore, it did require an amendment. So the next one we kind of want to get into, and Governor Clinton, just so you know, he was a hardcore anti-federalist, so we kind of skip over that. But let's look at Mr. Lansing's comments on encroachments, because he's an anti-federalist that happened to be in the convention. So let's, and we just reading the convention, we can see what his comments are. Let's go ahead and read that. That is down on June 24th, and it's just before June 25th. The Honorable Mr. Lansing.
Encroachments. Mm-hmm. Correct?
Yep.
The states having no constitutional control would soon be found unnecessary and useless and would be gradually extinguished. When this took place, the people would lose their liberties and be reduced from the condition of citizens to that of subjects. It had been remarked that there are more than 2,000 state representatives throughout the Union, and that the number of civil and military officers on the state establishments would far exceed those of the United States. In these circumstances, it has been said, we create such an attachment and dependence on the state governments as we give them a superiority over the general government. But, said he, were the states arrayed in all the powers of sovereignty? Could they maintain armies? Had they unlimited power of taxation? There was no comparison, he said, between the powers of the two governments. The circumstances the gentleman had enumerated, which seemed to be in favor of the states, only proved that the people would be under some advantages to discern the encroachments of Congress and to take the alarm. But what would this signify? The gentleman did not mean that his principles should encourage rebellion. What other resource had they? None, but to wait patiently to long term though their senators were expired and then elect other men. All the boasted advantages enjoyed by the states were finally reduced to this. The gentleman had spoken of an enmity which would subsist between the general and state governments. What, then, would be the situation of both? His wish, he said, was to prevent any enmity by giving the states a constitutional and peaceable mode of checking maladministration by recalling their senators and not driving them into hostilities in order to obtain redress.
And so what he may be mentioning is the lack of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. But if you go through the points that he brings up, that the states could not maintain a standing army, well, actually, they're required to maintain a militia and an active militia. So the militia being the army, why does he care whether you're calling it the militia or the army? It is the national defense system. It is the state defense system. It is the national law enforcement system. It should have been the state enforcement system as well. But instead, New York opted back in 1828 or 29, New York City opted to create a mercenary force instead of using the New York County, whatever it is, because they got these different boroughs, that county or that borough, the sheriff would basically have a crew, instead of having a police department, using the sheriffs. And there's no reason why they couldn't actually consolidate for the city of New York, like today, because the city is just that big, to create a governor and or a lead sheriff for the entire city, so that each of the counties, you know, kind of report to and have this kind of a headquarters. But you don't have to have a municipal, or I should say, a mercenary force. You create a mercenary force. You create an argument to take away guns from the people. You use the militia. You're maintaining the argument that the people need to have their guns because they're all about, they're all equally responsible for enforcing the law. Anyway, if you go through all of his other little points like the power taxation and so forth, it really doesn't hold merit. And so when you look at what he's asserting, the only way these things can be trampled on at the state level is for the federal government to actually bypass and say, you know, you don't have to maintain that militia without amending the Constitution. Because the Constitution demands that the Congress have the power to call forth the militia from the states must have a ready militia. This is exclusive legislation. Now, this isn't necessarily a person, individual. This is a resolution that came forward. Let me see. There probably is a name on it. Yeah, this is coming from Mr. Lansing. Oh, no. This is Mr. Smith, who actually had this as a resolution. In other words, an amendment to the Constitution over the exclusive legislation over the District of Columbia for Congress. This is Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 16.
That the right of the Congress to exercise exclusive legislation over such district, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may by cession of particular states in the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States, shall not be so exercised as to exempt the inhabitants of such district from paying the same taxes, duties, imposts, and excises as shall be imposed on the other inhabitants of the state where such district may be, nor shall it be so exercised as to prevent the laws of the state and all process under those laws from extending to such district. In all cases of crime committed without the district, or in cases of contracts made between persons residing within such district and persons residing without it, nor shall it be so exercised as to authorize any inhabitant of the said district to bring any suit in any court which may be established by the Congress within the same against any citizen or person not an inhabitant of the said district. And it is understood that the stipulations in this Constitution respecting all essential rights shall extend as well to this district as to the United States in general. Resolved further, as the opinion of this committee, that the right of exclusive legislation with respect to such places as may be purchased for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, and dockyards, and other needful buildings, shall not be construed to authorize the Congress to make any law to prevent the laws of the states in which they may lie from extending to such places in all civil and criminal matters, except as to such persons as shall be in the service of the United States, nor to them with respect to crimes committed without such places.
So, I know you read that, but did that make sense what he was talking about? Do you kind of understand
what
he was...
I mean, they're saying that it's going to still be part of the state and subject to their laws.
Right, but okay, at the very beginning he talks about citizens of a state that's living in the district for a temporary period of time. And he wants to make them exempt from the taxes, that they will still be subject to the taxes from the state to which they came.
Right.
Okay.
I thought he said it's not to be exempt.
That they are not to be exempt? He's recommending...
Not to be exempt.
Okay.
They shall not be so exercised as to exempt the inhabitants of such district from paying the same taxes, duties imposed, and excises shall be imposed on the other inhabitants of the state
where
the district may be.
Right. So what
they're saying is they can't exempt them from the taxes of the state.
I get that. Okay. Correct. Okay. No, but the possible tug, because when you're residing in two places, there are certain taxes. Like property tax. If they have property tax, then you should be paying taxes wherever you have property. And if you actually have
I'm trying to think here.
What would be an applicable tax that would be local, but that would not be applied to you if you're not there? Sales tax.
What about like the thing in New York with what's his name, Ken Griffin, where Mom Donnie went and called him out and said he owns this building. It's a however many tens of millions of dollars of the building, and he doesn't even live in the state that he should get extra taxes because he doesn't live there.
So, because this is what we've kind of talked about. If you're not living somewhere, but or you own things and you're not living there, let's say you own a business, is it okay? And let's put the extreme on this. Is it okay for Bill Gates to buy a home and to put a business in a state where he doesn't reside, where he's not answerable criminally within that state?
No.
There you go. We need to start backing up and start understanding the risks that we have when we allow people to operate across state boundaries, because jurisdiction is everything. It's one thing to live in a state, you know, temporarily as a geographic bachelor, what have you, and whether you're going to be able to buy property or not is up to the state, but I encourage the state to actually have a higher tax or to create a tax for anybody that is using rental property. In other words, if you don't live in that state and what you're doing is you're just building apartments, then the people that live in that state that maintain those apartments, they will pay an in-state tax. You, out of state, will pay an out-of-state tax, and that tax will be a lot more. What we have to do is we have to make it almost a punitive to not allow businesses to be owned and operated, and actually make it legally impossible as far as business goes, as far as I'm concerned. Because if that person doesn't live within your state boundaries, and this comes to a crime-level problem, they've committed a criminal offense by the way they've treated or what they've done with that business, that, you know, they should be immediately being able to be arrested, brought in, arraigned, you know, by an indictment from a grand jury, blah, 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 and answer for their crime. This is why I think businesses, no. And that's good. And a business can be, it can include a farm. It can include any kind of agricultural, you know, what do you want to call that? Forestry, you know, like lumber or so forth. I honestly think that we have to start reevaluating. But he's bringing up this very good point of looking at how they treat the citizens who are only there temporary, and they want to make sure that they still have their hooks in them while they're living there. Now, I do believe that if you're not there for a specific event or you're not there creating a drain or like on the roads, do you still pay a road tax? Let's say your state invokes a tax on your car for how many miles you've driven. And all those miles you've driven have been in the District of Columbia and the states around it and have not been any miles on the car or in the state that they want to tax that. And so at the end of the year, they want to see your car. They want to get the mileage off of it. And they want to tax you for that. Should he have to pay for the road tax, road use? No. I mean, sometimes I think that they have to have those exemptions. But for the most part, if you are a citizen, you should not have, you know, most of the regular tax exemptions. Same thing with responsibilities. But back in those days, if you lived away from your home, you couldn't vote. There was no mail forwarding back in their days. Society back then was very independent. There wasn't this mutual symbiosis between, or these interdependencies between foreign trade channels of distribution. They were pretty much self-sustaining. I mean, families were self-sustaining. They went into town to get their supplies. I mean, there were certain supplies that they started utilizing because it was making life better, making life easier. But let's reel this in here. We are addressing this situation, this paradigm that's being brought up here in the Pennsylvania debates that creates the situation of a state citizen who takes up residence out of state, basically going to the D.C. area without really moving out as citizens. Today, it's a lot more complicated because when you really look at what they're talking about, I believe that there's direct concerns and direct matters and issues that we need to be aware of or we need to address directly, because I see these problems playing out with one state inhabitants, non-real residents, in other words, people buying property, people having businesses that are not residents. I see this with these out-of-state residents as well, where people are doing that. If a state wants to actually try to have a policy where they want their residents and their citizens to intermingle and meddle with other state governments, and they don't want to create measures to kind of keep them in check, that's up to that state. States are sovereign. States are independent. It is in the best interest of every state to protect its citizens, their sovereignty, their resources. This goes hand in hand with what we see going on with this whole global movement of basically saying, hey, you know, we're all a part of the world now, and we're going to put data centers, we're going to start monitoring you, we're going to invade you. And so these things that we're seeing today are true warning signs. Back then, they were only worried about lost revenue. I am here to tell you, folks, we're losing our property. We're losing our future because our food is being taken from us, our ability to self-sustain. These things are very important. But the ratification debates and what we're going through is an awesome snapshot of how these men were very cognitive of what they were dealing with, where they were going, and what they wanted to see. Now, okay, the state was going to lose a little money with them being out, no longer being there, but didn't mean that there were certain taxes that they would have to pay. Now, I find it kind of money grubbing and a little, you know, I'll just say money grubbing, leave it with that. Because the root of the problem that they're looking at are trying to find ways to basically reject the Constitution. That's what the Anti-Federalist's goal is here. And the reality is, what needs to happen is they needed to get this union galvanized so that the federal government could do the very few things that they needed it to do so that the states could flourish. Again, the people and the motive driving behind this was protecting a power broker system. And I'm really surprised that, you know, Pennsylvania was so arduous. I mean, it was such a heated debate. And I say that because it took so long. Excuse me. What I see with Pennsylvania is they didn't have the cabals like Virginia and or these power brokers to protect. So with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic, and we need your help. God bless.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.